Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest today is Jim Capretta, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Jim was also an associate director at the Bush White House Office of Management and Budget from 2001 to 2004, where he had responsibility for healthcare, social security, education, and welfare programs. Jim, welcome to the Innovative Ideas podcast.
Thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be with you on the program again.
Jim, this is an extraordinarily busy week for healthcare policy. The Supreme Court this week, among other issues, is going to be reviewing the constitutionality of the individual mandate. Last week, Chairman Paul Ryan in the House released his plan for entitlement reform, particularly Medicare reform, based on a vision of premium support, and we can talk about that a little bit later. And then the presidential election is really heating up now. I think the forces are going to be aligned, I think, between the presumptive Republican nominee, whoever that may be. I think it's safe to assume right now that's probably going to be Governor Romney, but let's waive that for the moment and just say the presumptive nominee is probably going to embrace something like the Ryan plan or something close to it. The president is going to have his own option based on, I think, what we've seen from the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, up to this point. I'd like to start off by addressing the Supreme Court constitutionality issue a little bit obliquely, and that's by way of saying the individual mandate is there because really young people have been priced out of the insurance system in the U.S. because of the tax treatment of health insurance and because people who don't get insurance through their employers have to purchase it at a sharp disadvantage. And then the Affordable Care Act actually adds a number of mandates and costs onto insurance that make it even more expensive for these young, relatively healthy people. And so the mandate is really there to try to compel them to pay into a system that they couldn't afford to pay into without substantial government subsidies. Can you talk a little bit about how the mandate, in effect, is designed to fix a problem that the government created?
Right, that's a very good point, Paul. The if you look what's going on in Massachusetts, they have an individual mandate that was enacted in 2006, began operation in 2007. And prior to that, they had a heavily regulated insurance market where the young people in the state basically had to pay premiums close to what someone in the higher end of the age spectrum had to pay in terms of premiums. And, of course, young people are much lower health risks than older people. And so a young person in Massachusetts looked at that market prior to the individual mandate and said, I have some risk associated with something happening to me, but boy, I'm paying premiums that far, far exceed my risk. And that's essentially subsidizing, the health care for older citizens in the state. And so they opted out of the system. Now, Massachusetts then comes along and says, hey, you know what? You can't opt out of the system. What we're going to do is make you buy insurance. And what we'll do is we'll subsidize you to buy insurance. So, it's sort of solving the government problem by not undoing the cause of the high premiums in the first place, but actually just sort of doubling down on the problem and saying, look, we're going to make you buy the insurance at this high premium, and we'll just use taxpayer money to sort of make the premium look artificially low to you. That's really what's going on. And, of course, incidentally, in Massachusetts, that they make it sound like some great new innovation they came up with. All they basically took federal money to subsidize those people. So they said, hey, let's use a bunch of federal taxpayer money funneled through the Medicaid program and use that to subsidize these premiums for these people we're now going to make to buy insurance. So there's nothing really magical about that at all. It's sort of kind of backwards, as you indicated by your question. And I think the underlying cause of all this is of course, that you don't have an insurance system that is operating like a true marketplace, largely because to get stable insurance today, you have to be part of an employer group in most instances. So young people who are just entering the workforce, sometimes they're working part-time, they're still going to school, they're just at the beginning stages of their career, so maybe they aren't in really stable employment yet. That means they're prone to being outside of the large employer-based healthcare system, where they have to pay, if they were going to get health insurance, they have to pay it directly out of their pocket without a tax preference. If we would simply start to undo that and allow people who are buying in the individual market have the same kind of tax treatment as people in the large employer system, some of that problem would start to even out naturally. And then if we allowed the insurance system at the state level to operate like a true market where insurers could price products that are attractive to young people, presumably with higher deductibles, maybe just catastrophic protection in case they really need a lot of expensive health care. You could actually offer premiums that were attractive to people, and people would sign up for them. I think a further issue here is we need to understand that people will sign up for insurance and stay continuously insured if you give them incentives to do so. If they can get into the insurance system without any penalty, then, of course, they'll wait until they're sick and they really need it. So you have to have an insurance system that has the right incentives, and that can be done. It can be done, but it's certainly not done in the healthcare law. And a lot of these issues are, of course, being discussed this very day in the Supreme Court.
So, obviously, you did a great job of summarizing. We've got a very complicated system here, hurt by the fact, as you pointed out, the tax subsidy for insurance drives through employers. Also, the fact that individuals cannot buy insurance across state lines in a way that would incentivize policymakers in individual states to actually offer policy designs that were really attractive to young and healthy people. New York, for instance, has community rating and guaranteed issue, two policies that sharply drive up the cost of insurance for healthy people and particularly for younger people. And then if you step back and look at the healthcare spending problem, and I know you've done an awful lot of thinking and writing on this topic, everyone talks on the left and the right about uncontrollable, or I don't know about uncontrollable is right, but at least runaway healthcare spending. But again, getting back to these are policies that we have consciously created, perhaps not aware of the unintended effects we'd have decades later, of how the subsidy structure, both through the tax system, as you just discussed, and then through programs like Medicare that are based on what's called fee-for-service, which is seniors can go anywhere they want, see any physician they want, and get care there. And Medicare will pay regardless of the quality of that care, whether or not it's terrific care, not very good care, or even fraudulent or wasteful care, very hard to control spending. And that echoes throughout the rest of the healthcare system. Can you talk a little bit about, so we've talked about the individual mandate and how that's a little bit of a backdoor way of trying to address a more fundamental problem. And then here, the Medicare, the 800-pound gorilla in the system, how does that drive healthcare spending far beyond what it might be?
Those are all good points. Well, it's important to realize that in American healthcare, the federal government's already got its fingers, pretty much into everything. Most Americans get their health insurance through one of three sources that is already heavily subsidized by the federal government, right? So we already talked about employer-based health insurance. If you're getting through an employer, that has tax subsidy associated with that, which is open-ended, so it's unlimited, which provides a pretty strong incentive for employers and the workers to opt for higher and higher health benefits in lieu of cash wages, because the health benefit is not taxed and the cash wages are. So on the margins, when people have to make a choice, hey, do I want that more in a health benefit or do I want it more in cash, a lot of union negotiated contracts and even workers who are expressing preferences in terms of what they get from their employers, they express a preference for a very generous health benefit because it's entirely tax-free. So that open-ended tax subsidy is encouraged very expansive third-party insurance through the employer system. Then you add to that Medicare and Medicaid, which the federal government heavily, heavily subsidizes and, in fact, runs in the case of Medicare. You have, in both of those cases, also the same dynamic applies, which is that the more expensive the health care, the more the government will subsidize in terms of taxpayer payments to provide that coverage. So, again, in Medicare and Medicaid, there's strong incentives for more and more use of services and higher and higher volume, because that really comes at the expense of taxpayers, not the program's enrollees. Now, what does that mean? That means that the federal government's costs in healthcare, both on the tax expenditure side for employer-based healthcare and for Medicare and Medicaid, have been soaring. So over the last four decades, just in the entitlement sphere, basically a 4 or 5 percentage points of GDP increase in spending just on Medicare and Medicaid. So back in the early 70s, they were very, very small as the size of the economy and certainly small as a proportion of the total federal budget. Today they're gigantic, and they're expected to balloon by another 6 percentage points over the next 25 years due to Obamacare and population aging. So Medicare and Medicaid plus this tax provision for employer-provided health care are really the number one problems in the federal budget. Again, getting back to what that means for the health care law and what it tried to do to solve it, instead of getting at this root problem and trying to fix, the federal government pouring gasoline essentially on the fire, what the health care law does is essentially say, hey, You know, the problem here is that not everybody is in that system. It's true it's going up very, very rapidly, but we need to subsidize even more people into that, you know, very rapidly growing cost structure, and then we'll try to control costs. So the basic thrust of the healthcare law is to subsidize even more people into Medicaid and into a structure called the health exchanges, which essentially will mimic, in terms of cost growth, the Medicaid program too. So now we've got basically on schedule many tens of millions of more people coming into a health entitlement structure that is already bankrupting, you know, the federal government and bankrupting the health system. And really, the healthcare law's number one goal and objective was essentially to subsidize even more people into that unreformed system. That's really what happened. The individual mandate is intended to try to force people to buy into that structure over time. The problem is that, you know, what's naturally going to happen and what really is worrisome is that when you put a mandate on the public, an individual mandate like that, to say you need to buy into a system with rapid cost growth, the citizens will eventually turn around and say to the people running the political system, hey, fine, you made us buy into this insurance system, but now you, the political system, you need to control costs to make it affordable. So the burden for cost control will naturally shift onto political actors, the Congress and the executive branch, and they'll be under a heavy burden politically to say, if we're going to make people buy this insurance, we can't let the premium go up 7, 8, 9% a year. So within a few years of the mandate going into effect, just like has happened in Massachusetts, nationwide there will be an impetus to put on cost control caps or something. And that'll end up being a very blunt instrument, you know, some kind of premium caps or price controls, the effect of which will be to enmesh the government even more into running the health system. I think over time that'll really diminish the quality, and the government will end up, you know, in a de facto sense, taking over the entire system in a certain way.
And really, the government has put itself in a very awkward position here because, you know, I call this the army base problem. Because once you've decided that you're going to essentially subsidize every physician and hospital in the U.S., it's extraordinarily difficult to cut anyone out of that network or local regional networks for cost or quality issues, simply because there's going to be an enormous backdrop. And as my friend Doug Holtz-Eakin likes to say, every congressional district in America has doctors and hospitals in it. So it makes it extraordinarily difficult to have the kind of networking or tiering, as they call it in the insurance industry, where you'd say, we're only going to cover these people because we think that they're really fantastic and offer high quality, affordable care. Everybody else is going to be out. So the option then becomes, let's just cut reimbursement rates across the board for everyone. That's really the tactic that you alluded to. It's in the Affordable Care Act, where really there's these flat cuts for hospitals across the board, productivity quote-unquote cuts. And as you alluded to, the Medicare actuary, Richard Foster, has even said, this is going to be unsustainable. You cannot cut this much out and just assume these productivity gains, and seniors are going to suffer for it as care declines. So what's the alternative here? I think we know that Chairman Ryan has put out an alternative. Why are you optimistic that premium support is going to be ultimately more effective in the system than strategies like the president proposed, where we've got either these across-the-board cuts or the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which is also in the Affordable Care Act, where you have a team of experts who are just going to say, okay, we're going to cut this, we're going to cut that?
And, you know, I'm optimistic because I think when consumers are really brought into the equation and they have a premium that they can reduce if they opt for a low-cost plan, that puts a tremendous incentive on those that are operating in the system to find a way to give them that premium. And if you do surveys of people, I mean, it sounds silly almost to say, but some people seem to be shocked by it. When you ask consumers out there in America what they're looking for, you know, when they have to choose, what are they looking for in a health insurance plan for themselves and their families? And the number one concern is, surprise, low premiums. The American consumer would really like to be able to buy a high-quality, low-premium plan for their health care. You know, no shock there. But they really don't have that as an option today. There's no marketplace from which they could operate and act to try to make that happen. If you move toward a system of premium support where the government is saying, in effect, here's a fixed level of contribution we're going to give you to support your health insurance. If you buy a more expensive plan, the entire extra cost is coming out of your pocket. But if you buy a lower cost plan, you get to save 100% of the savings entirely and keep it yourself. With that kind of incentive, you get the incentives right, and the consumer then says, hey, I'm going to go and try to get the best deal I can because the government's contribution is not going to go up if I take a more expensive plan. And in that regard, then it turns the burden back away from the government trying to figure out how to do cost control, but back on the doctors and the hospitals and the insurance plans they're working with to come up with a system that is attractive in a marketplace. And I think that really would get the ball rolling for the kind of dynamic, sometimes a little bit disruptive change that needs to occur in the health system to weed out excess costs, really examine carefully business processes. How are we taking care of patients when they come into a hospital? What do we do with them at the clinic level? Really examine the cost structures of the big parts of the health delivery system to get the cost down. And that's really what needs to happen. And it only probably will happen if that is done to please and enroll consumers in a network system that includes those hospitals and doctors.
And then let me offer one thought in support of your observation, and that is, I think we saw back in the mid-1990s that managed care could work, and that all the data, at least that I've seen, suggested that it held down costs pretty well and was, the quality stayed the same, basically. But I think that what really frustrated people was they felt like it was something that was thrust upon them. They really couldn't choose it. And there wasn't, I think from the top down, a data-driven, quality-driven approach to say, yes, this is why our network is really good. And I think that a little bit the industry was in the position of, or America was in the position of, where IT was, at the early start of the 90s or the late 80s, where we're saying we're putting all this money into IT, but we're not seeing these productivity improvements. Where are they going? Are we just flushing our money down the toilet? But then by the mid-1990s, Walmart, other companies had really figured out how to use IT to just drive productivity really powerfully across the economy, drive costs down, drive productivity up. I think healthcare or health insurance is getting to that point today. We have tremendous access to data. Companies are getting better and better about mining that data, both insurance companies and employers. I think we're finally at the position of being able to say, here are the good providers, here are the high quality providers that are also offering low cost. I think that kind of information should increasingly make people more comfortable if you create the right framework for the marketplace that makes it transparent and accessible for making those kinds of quality comparisons and getting particularly seniors comfortable with, over time, moving into a system that, after all, is already in Medicare for Part D, but also for the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan.
Exactly. No, I think you're exactly right, Paul. I mean, when you go in this kind of a direction, it opens up all kinds of possibilities. And it's true that managed care, I think, basically worked in the 90s, but I think we're even at a point now where the kinds of innovations that could be brought forward are not just the kinds of denying people access to a specialist or something like that. I think it's really about organizing the system so that it operates more efficiently and in a way that actually the patients themselves would like better. I mean, the amount of communication that's done between the delivery system and patients on an electronic basis is incredibly small compared to the rest of our society. And, the HIT developments you mentioned, really the next phase of it is to really have consumers engaged in an electronic interaction with those who are delivering services to them. We haven't even tapped into the beginning of that. And the ability to harness that to actually deliver better services to patients, I think, would be immense. But it's not necessarily going to come about unless the consumer can opt for it. Because if the government is trying to make it happen through regulation and subsidies, there's very little incentive for the doctors and hospitals to do it unless the government pays them to do it. And so they're sort of waiting around always to, hey, when's the government going to pony up more money for me to invest in a new, system that will be a little bit more patient-oriented? They're not going to do it until the government gives them money to do so. So the whole system needs to have a different focus and orientation for it really to take off.
And I think that's really the going to be the crux of the debate for the next several months, and certainly in November, as the president, whoever his Republican challenger is going to be, posits those two opposite visions of the future of healthcare. I think one of them is going to be much more top down, modeled after the Affordable Care Act, much more managed from on high by unelected bureaucrats, and then a more bottom up, consumer driven model. Jim, thanks very much for your time today. We look forward to having you on again.
Thanks, Paul. I really enjoyed it.